My name is Ann Smith, and I am a volunteer at the Sam Proctor Oral History Program at the University of Florida. And we are in Pew Hall this morning, and I am interviewing Tom Sartarsiana.
Very good.
And it's February the 19th, 2009, and we really appreciate you willing to participate in this. It's a real pleasure for me, Tom. Why don't you state your full name and spell it then for the person who's going to do the transcribing?
Thomas Dominic Santacero.
Okay.
Just the last name only?
Just the last name.
Santarsiero.
Okay. Now, is that an Italian name?
It is an Italian name.
How's that for a good guess?
There it is.
And where were you born, Tom?
Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo, New York. And can you tell me when?
May 15, 1925.
1925. That was a very good year.
Now, we weren't born in hospitals in those days.
You were born at home. Were you the first?
Midwives. No, I'm the last one of nine.
Of nine. So you had a lot to live up to.
Oh, yeah. Well, most of my family's gone right now.
Yeah.
I had six sisters, three brothers. My one sister, Josephine, and myself were the last of the family.
Uh-huh.
The rest have all passed away.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, now you grew up in Buffalo?
Yes.
In a close Italian family?
Oh, yeah, very, very close. Mm-hmm. Very close family. We had, nine of us, plus my mother and father and my grandmother, we all lived in one house.
Uh-huh.
And we managed. It was during the time of Depression.
What did your father do for a living?
He was on construction. He was a supervisor on construction.
Uh-huh.
And outdoor construction, road construction.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, he helped build some of the locks for the Erie Barge Canal.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
And your mother was a stay-at-home?
Housewife, yes.
Housewife. She had her hands full.
She had her hands full with nine kids.
I guess so.
Because in those days, you didn't have washing machines or...
That's right.
Everything was done by hand.
And then she trained all of the kids to do their part.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Everybody had a... I was the gopher child because I was the youngest one.
Uh-huh. Tell me now, what was your childhood like growing up?
Well, we were poor, of course, during Depression, I guess most people, but we didn't know we were poor because everyone else was poor. But we were a very close family and close neighbors. You didn't have to lock your house doors or anything. Mm-hmm. Wherever you went, it was a different lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have the types of entertainment you got today with the Nintendos and television.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most of the stuff we were kids, we would get involved in swimming or baseball or sports.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much, we kept our neighbors. We were all close, very close with one another. We helped one another.
Was food an important part of
family? In those days, yeah. Well, it was a little different. They had no child labor laws, in those days. And I remember when we used to go to, when I was going to grammar school, I'm talking maybe 7, 8, 9 years old. The last day of school was June 21st, and the 22nd, we were out on the farm picking strawberries.
Were you?
We were working from daybreak till dusk.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't, it was part of the lifestyle.
Yeah, everyone.
Whatever money we made, everything went to Mama. She took care of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we lived on in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
Welfare in those days was a lot different. The best you can get from them was maybe some dried milk, dried eggs, powdered eggs, and
mm-hmm.
things like that,
yeah.
Canned goods. But most of the time, people were too proud to go there, and they managed. We managed, and we helped one another.
Were you a good student? Did you like school?
Oh, I enjoyed school. I enjoyed school, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was an average student.
Yeah. Was there anyone in your family that was in military service?
My brother Joe and my brother Tony, they were both in the military service.
Mm-hmm.
My brother Tony was in the Air Force.
And you were younger than he was.
Oh, yeah, I was much younger. I was the baby.
So what do you remember from their experiences?
Well, of course, it was hard, you know. Let's back up a little bit here. My parents died. They both died in 1941.
Oh, I see.
My father died in April, and my mother died in October that same year. I was 16 years old.
16.
15 and 16, see.
Oh, that was really hard for you, wasn't it?
Well, I lived with my sister Josephine. She was, well, there was Lucy, Millie, and Josephine, and Marie. Well, she was fourth one from the bottom. She was the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And she had just gotten married, and I had lived with her after my parents died.
I see.
I stayed with her.
And this was still in Buffalo?
Still in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, it was the same home I lived in. She just moved in with her husband.
Yeah, sure.
And we lived together.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with them.
Well, now, was religion a big part of your life?
Very much so.
Growing up?
Very much so. At that time, we were, you know, Catholics, but
yes.
You know, we went to church and all that.
Uh-huh.
Later on, we changed it. Denominations.
Right? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But you remember growing up, and that was an important part
very much so.
Of your upbringing.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you said now both of them were in the service. Joe and Tony were in the service.
Right.
And they would come home with stories about...
Anthony was stationed down in Pine Castle down in Orlando, around Orlando area.
Yes.
And he was there for... through much of the war.
Uh-huh.
I didn't come in until later. I don't know what year he went in, but probably 43, 42 or 43 he went in, I would say.
What do you think influenced you to join the service?
I didn't join, I was drafted. As soon as I turned 18, because I went to high school, and I went to a vocational school, which I don't know if you're familiar with, it was half... a regular high school and half vocational.
Mm-hmm.
You had a little few longer hours, but they taught you the normal high school subjects, and then we took 3 hours or 2 hours of aviation mechanics
mm-hmm.
to use in a later day.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I left school, I got myself a part-time job in the summer. Well, I got a job in the summer with Curtis and Bell, which were aircraft companies. But that didn't last very long because right after that I was drafted.
Yeah, yeah.
I had turned 18.
So when were you inducted into the service?
No, October of 1943.
Uh-huh.
And I actually went in November of 43.
Okay.
I went into Camp Upton. And then from there, as a matter of fact, when I went into Camp Upton, they interviewed us there, and when they saw my background being an aviation mechanic, they said, "How would you like to go in the Air Force?" And I said, "Well, sure, I'd love that." And he says, "Okay." So they gave me an MOS number for Air Force. But the 3 days I was there, they had come out with an edict. All MOS numbers were canceled. Everyone was 745, which is riflemen.
Oh, really?
Infantry. As a matter of fact, if you were familiar at that time with football, Johnny Lujack, who played for Notre Dame, he was a quarterback for Notre Dame, he was drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the outfit with me, next door to me, because everybody, they canceled all the officer trainers, all of the boys that were coming in to go to officer training school, they canceled everything and put us into infantry.
And why was that?
Because they were preparing for D-Day. Omaha Beach.
So
now, this is October, November of 43.
So all the other deals were
everything.
Off.
So when they transferred me from Upton, they sent me to Fort McClellan, Alabama for basic training. Of course, when I got into basic training, he looked at my background and he said, "Well, you have too much technical background to go straight infantry." He says, "Would you like to get into either pioneering, radio, or telephone?" Well, I didn't know what, at the time, I hadn't given much thought.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Let me know it by tomorrow." So I did, and I said, And I checked in, and they said telephone would probably be better off suited. So I did. I took telephone linemen and infantry.
And where did you take that then?
Is Fort McClellan, Alabama.
In Alabama?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then when I finished that training, with basic training, which was a 16-week course, they gave us a delay en route. This was in April.
Okay.
They gave us a delay en route. From there, I went to Buffalo, 10-day furlough.
Yeah.
And then from there, they sent us to Fort Meade, Maryland, and gave us all new equipment, new rifle, new clothes, everything. They gave us everything new. And then from Fort Meade, they sent us to Camp Shanks, which was a port of embarkation. I think that was in New Jersey. Was it New Jersey or New York? I'm not sure exactly, because we used to come over to guard George Washington Bridge.
How do you spell Shanks?
S-H-A-N-K-S.
Okay, thank you.
Now here, I had an experience, which I thank the Lord for. We were only supposed to be there 3 days. Mm-hmm. Now they took us and got us all prepared. And they had a convoy in New York. And they took us to the convoy and they put me on a ship called the Eastern Prince. Remember that one? They kept us there overnight. And the ship was sinking in the harbor, so they pulled us off, all of the troops that were on that ship. And they had said, everybody from A to M, a left column, from N to Z, right column. So we split up.
Yeah.
And they took all of us from M to Z back to Camp Shanks, and the rest they found ships in the harbor, in the convoy, to place them on. That, I think, saved me from D-Day.
Oh.
This, we're talking April. Okay, so they kept us, brought us back to Camp Shanks, and we were there for over 3 weeks. They kept us until a new convoy was able to form. Thank you, Lord.
Oh, that was just...
Now, they had gone over, and we had got on another convoy, and they got on a captured Italian ship called the Monticello.
Mm-hmm.
And they took us. It was a luxury liner. What they did is, of course, they had barbed wire, a fence around, and you could see all the gambling tables and stuff piled up in the center.
Yeah.
And they had made bunks. In those days, they used welded pipe with bunks that you slept in. And they put us on that, and it took us 14 days to get from New York to England. We landed in Liverpool. And then from there, they took us to Bath, England. And they kept us there in reserve. And I think I remember D-Day because, now, according to my records, it states that we didn't go over until late June. And I can't verify the dates. But I remember we were camped in Bath. In England, I remember the daylight hours, you only had about 4 hours of darkness there.
Yeah.
It was 3-4 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I remember airplanes, nothing but, the sky was black with airplanes. We were sleeping in pup tents.
Mm-hmm.
And that morning, the sky was black with airplanes. And I feel that's the beginning of D-Day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, my records show that I didn't go over until July, but I think that's wrong because I was over there before then.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, that's neither here nor there. They kept us there I had a little experience. I met a fellow, his name was Norm Shapiro, and he was telling me, he said, you know, Tom, he said, we're going to be going into combat. He said, they're looking for paratroopers. He says, you know, we should go over and look. And says, he said, because they told us we'd take at least 3 weeks of training before we go into combat. And I told him, well, I said, no, I don't think so. He says, why don't you come? He says, let's go check it out. I said, all right. So we did. And we went over and we passed the physical test. But when it came time to sign, you know, something in the back, a little voice kept saying, don't sign. And I didn't. You know, I says, I don't think so. He says, no, come on. He says, I think you're making a mistake. I says, no, I'll take my chances here, Norm. So I went back and he went in. And He wrote back to me, I don't know, was this on a Wednesday or Thursday? They made him jump out of a tower the following day. The next day, he jumped out of an airplane. Then the third day, he made a night jump. The fourth day, he said they were giving him preparation. And the fifth day, he landed in southern France.
Oh,
in the combat.
That doesn't sound like 3 weeks.
And, whoa. I said, thank you, Lord, again, you know.
Oh.
So I was spared. And they kept us in reserve for 3 weeks, actually. So we went over to France, and we landed in Omaha Beach on LCIs. That was called Landing Craft Infantry LCIs. And I told you the story. Would you want me to repeat that
again?
Yeah,
I sure do.
They took us to the shore. Of course, these days you can go in, it's only so far. And the load, the ramp wouldn't come down. And of course, there's water up to here inside these LCIs. And we were the two and the lieutenant, I don't know who he was, he just says, you stay here. And we had to lift the guys up over the top of the ramp to come down into the water, see? So they did.
And how deep was the water when they
landed? Well, the water was maybe only knee deep, a little deeper. And after we got everybody in, they grabbed my hand to pull me up, and we slipped, and I fell back in again. I was soaking wet. And they finally got me out, and we jumped over, and they had, like I had told you, they had stuffed the duffel bags that we were carrying up alongside this like a wall, maybe 100 feet high, and it was part of the beach, the end of the beach there. I looked for my bag, I couldn't find it, and I think there were two left, and I grabbed one, and like I told you before, it was a lieutenant, it was an officer's bag, but I didn't care because once we moved inland about a mile where we had camped, I had taken all my clothes off and I put his clothes on for till mine dried. Once mine dried, I took his off and put it back in the bag. And we worried about it later on. From there, we went up to St. Lo, and that's where I joined my outfit, the 28th Division. And like I told you, I remember the first day of going up to the front, I remember it was an elevated road, and we had gone through the town, which the town was pretty bad, or St. Lo was pretty well flattened. There weren't any buildings standing. It was
how do you spell St. Lo?
It's ST-LO.
Okay.
They had taken us through the town. There was a little sniper firing, but nothing to, you know, that really mattered any. And they had taken us up. We were going up to the front line. And I remember this elevated road, and I was kicking. There were clips from the M1 rifle. They're telling me, you're pretty close to the front line, you know.
And this is your first taste.
First day they're taking us up. And I remember we were watching a P-38 fight, a Mr. Schmidt dogfight. We were standing there and we were all yelling, hey, go get him, you know, go get him. And of course, that only lasted a few minutes and then they were gone. And then they had taken us up. By this time, I'd say it was all maybe 6 o'clock at night in the evening, still daylight. And we had gone in and there was a group of fellas standing around, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 of them, something like that. We were introducing each other. Like I told you, there was one fella sitting by a tree, and he had a shovel in his hand. He says, I got to go to John, he says, pretty soon, while he's sitting there. And we're just talking back and forth. All at once we hear this, was a mortar. It landed smack dead in the center where we were standing. It picked me up and slammed me against a tree. One guy, I told you, half his arm was ripped off. Another one, part of his leg was gone. A couple of them, they were bleeding. And I'm feeling myself around. Nothing happened to me. Thank you, Lord. And I wasn't wounded, but the concussion was pretty good. We called a medic over, and this guy's still sitting there with his shovel, never moving. And when they checked him, they found out a sliver of shrapnel had gone through him and pierced his heart, and he was dead instantly. He was killed. That was my first day of combat. Well, of course, we scattered whoever was left. I still don't know their names. We went in, dug in that night, and we took a pounding. Most of the night, they were shelling us. That was my indoctrination to... From then on, it was a nightmare. I always kind of try to say, combat is 70% boredom and 30% terror, fear.
Yeah.
Because most of the time you're waiting, and then when you go into battle, it lasts maybe 3-4 days, and then you sit for a week.
Yeah.
But it was, of course, you went on patrols. We had different type of patrols. We had to go on combat patrols and.
What kind of weather was this?
It was pretty good. We were still, it was, the weather was still good. It was summertime. It's July, you know, July and August. It's great weather. We had it was like normal northern weather.
Yeah.
Warm in the daytime, cool at night. Gorgeous weather. We didn't have to worry about any bad weather. The weather didn't take bad until late October and November. That's when it really got bad. But well, at that time, it was just normal weather.
And so then after that first day, and you kind of regrouped...
Well, we regrouped, but we took a pounding that night, and we stayed where we were. And that's when I was assigned to the squad. I remember his name was Sergeant Corey. He was our squad leader. The rest of the guys, I don't remember their names. I mean, it just, you weren't there long enough.
No.
I mean, they were there, we were there maybe a week. They're gone, and you got a whole new squad in. And I was fortunate enough to come through. Of course, you go on patrol at night, maybe 8-10 people, whoever was on patrol, sometimes less. You never come back with a full squad because you get caught.
Yeah.
And but usually when you got caught, you buddied up. You had a buddy system.
Yeah.
And whoever was with you, you stayed together.
Yeah.
You worked your way back to your outfit. And some came back, some didn't. And we replaced them with new replacements. Corey stayed with us for a while. The Sergeant Corey.
Yeah.
But I remember when we went on patrol one night, oh, it was just maybe a month later, and we got caught. The Germans had caught us. They shot us up pretty bad. But we made it back. Thank God I wasn't hurt. And all I heard was help. We were laying in our foxholes that night. All I could hear was help, help. Of course, we gave him the password, and he gave us the answer. And it was Corey. And he was crying like a baby. And we just broke down.
Yeah.
So I went over and got the lieutenant, and I said, "Lieutenant, I said, you better come and see Corey." I
says, yeah.
He came over, and he says, "I'm sending him back." He said, "This man has been through hell."
Yeah.
He says, he went through North Africa. He went to Sicily, Messina. He says, he went through D-Day. He says, and now, he says, he's had enough.
This is too much.
He says, I'm sending this man back. And then Corey was gone. I mean, but that poor guy, I mean, he really suffered. He suffered pretty bad. So we lost Corey, and then they were looking for someone to replace him.
Yeah.
I don't want it. I don't want a part of it. I don't want any field day. You know, they used to give you field promotion. I said, no, I'll help, but I don't want it.
Yeah.
They used to,
yeah.
It got to be, I was one of the oldest guys in the squad because we were losing them so fast.
Oldest guy at age what?
No, age 19.
Yeah.
So, but when I say oldest,
I mean,
the oldest combat, the veteran, I didn't have enough experience.
That's what I mean.
I only got a few, maybe a month, not even. And I said, no, I don't want that responsibility at this time because I didn't think I was qualified.
Yeah.
To take other people's
that's pretty heavy
responsibility.
That's pretty
heavy. I just didn't feel right. But I would take patrols out because I had some experience and we were all rookies. But getting back to Sergeant Corey, we went out on patrol one night and he was still with us at the time, I remember.
Yes.
And I remember stepping on something soft and I thought I was standing on a bouncing Betty, which is a landmine. And what they do is they pop up about 6 feet and then they explode. And as soon as I stepped on that, oh God, I'm on one, you know, because we were trained.
Yeah.
And I says, "Sarge," he come over and he says, "What?" I says, "I think I'm on a bouncing, buddy." Boy, everybody took off. They just scared. He stayed with me.
Yeah.
He says, "All right." He says, "You remember basic training, what they told you?"
Yeah.
I said, "Yeah." He says, "Now think, keep calm." He was real calm about it. He says, "Keep cool." I said, "All right." And I did. And you squat down. What you do is, when they exploded them during basic training, what they did is they put paper all around, uh-huh, and they let these bouncing Bettys come up and explode, and you could see the 90% of the shrapnel was up high.
Oh.
So you still got some that went down, but the majority of it was up high. So I just kind of squatted down, and I just jumped forward and flattened out. But it wasn't. It was, I wasn't standing that one. Again, I mean, that in itself was pretty bad.
Well, if you think you're on one, that's almost as bad.
You know, but I was blessed again, and it wasn't happening. Mm. Well, of course, we went out on patrol, and that night it was a combat patrol. What we did is we had come up down a ridge, and there was like a valley, and there were a bunch of Germans down there. We were looking at them. We saw a half track and a tank. And they were eating. I mean, they're having their lunch or supper.
Yeah.
It was late in the afternoon. It was almost dark. And I remember we were all in. Of course, what you do, open fire. You fire a clip in. You load another one. You're gone. You don't stay with them. Uh-huh. In other words, you didn't. You just irritated them is what you did. Uh-huh. You fired at them, shot at them. Of course, they're all scattering. And mess kits flying everywhere, and they're just taking off, and you hit a few of them, and then you're gone. You're back to your outfit. See, that was it, and that's all. That's all. That was just a harassment type of a. Mm. So we did that, and of course we went back to our outfit, and then we did quite a bit of hedgerow fighting till we got to Paris. Of course, I told you about the Paris where. Our outfit marched through Paris. They cleaned us up, gave us all new uniforms. We were spick and span going through with our rifles and marching through the streets of Paris, and all the people clapping and greeting us. We had gone through town. Then once we got on the other side of town, they took all our clothes away from us, gave us our fatigues again, our battle fatigues, and we were ready for combat again.
So it was a picture opportunity.
Oh, yeah, that's all that was. It was just a
parade for...
publicity thing. Hey, look at the Americans. We already conquered.
We're in Paris.
We're in Paris. See, we're on our way to victory, which was... Oh, that's right.
Let me backtrack about the hedgerows. See? And tell me what it was like trying
that to... That was bad. Hedgerow fighting was bad because the Germans, what they did is when they retreated, they knew the distance where they were to where they left, and they were already zeroed in with their artillery and their mortars. They knew where we were going to come through. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with hedgerows, but hedgerows are, mm-hmm, they're not easy. That they're like a brick wall is what they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they say hedgerows, they think it's just something growing. No, it's stuff growing through brick. I mean, it's tough to penetrate those things. Mm-hmm. And you saw the pictures of the fields. Well, you got all open fields between you and the hedgerow.
And so you're just a moving target.
You're a moving target. Plus, they're all, don't forget, there's landmines in there. There's tank mines in there. So what they did is the tanks had put something like a big bulldozer in front of them, like a blade.
Yeah.
To kind of clear before they went through. And the safe place usually is behind a tank. But you don't always want to be behind the tank because when they start shelling, they're trying to hit those tanks.
Yeah.
So after a while, you learn these things. You learn when to get behind the tank and when not to get behind the tank.
Yeah, yeah.
You kind of, it's called experience, you know. And it was tough. It was tough fighting the hedgerow. Hedgerow fighting was very tough. It was just, you're an open target because you saw that movie.
In between.
It's just all open.
And you're still having pretty decent weather at this
point. Oh, that's still good weather. Yet. We're still in good weather. Mm-hmm. We had good weather all the way up to the Siegfried Line. You know, that was, mm-hmm, pretty good there when we got into that too. That was still
So as you're crossing the hedgerows, and then you've gotten through Paris, and on the other side, then they give
you... We went right back to it. We were getting ready for the... after once we passed Paris, of course, we had this open... We're still fighting until we got to the Siegfried Line.
Yeah.
Which were the dragon's teeth. And that was that type of fighting. It was different now. You remember your pillboxes, they had a pretty good arrangement. Usually the pillboxes, like if you had one pillbox here, there were two more guarding this one. It was a pyramid type thing.
I see.
And it was tough. It wasn't as bad as some of the other battles we were in, but it was tough to Siegfried. And what was bad about the Siegfried was when we captured a pillbox, the Germans were sending their troops back in and killing American soldiers at nighttime, like special squads coming in, slitting throats and whatever have you.
Well, what did they tell you before you got to the Siegfried Line about what you could expect? Did they?
They just said it's going to be tough getting through because you're not going to have too much tank support getting through because of the. Of the dragon's teeth.
Dragon's teeth
they
would
had
prevent
to go through and usually rip somebody, and them things are buried quite a few feet down into the ground, see.
And what did they tell you about how to attack the pillboxes?
Well, when we would take the pillbox, we had to go in, like you say, with flamethrowers. Mm-hmm. They would shell, and the shelling isn't going to get at them. It usually had to take them by the infantry with flamethrowers go in and pick them right out. You had to go in and fight for them.
Yeah.
Hand grenades, throwing them into the... It was just pretty much hand-to-hand type stuff. You had to get in there.
Yeah.
And take them. And the pillboxes. Once we did take a pillbox, we would set up our troops. And they always told us, because when the Germans were coming back at night, they said, sleep back to back. So wherever you had with you, you put back to back, so that if anybody did come in, you'd be prepared. I can give you a little levity here. One night, I remember, it was a full moon, but there were clouds.
Yeah.
The clouds coming through. And we were up on a hill, and we had to set up machine guns. Now, if you're familiar with machine gun setup, you had a certain area, like you took from that tree to that tree, and that was it. You didn't go beyond that. Because the other machine guns would take their areas, and we had set this machine gun up. And I don't even remember the guy's name that I had to set it up with. And we had an old water-cooled one that we set up. And it was, like I said, a full moon, and there was this big valley down below us. And some clouds had come through, and it got real dark. And all we could hear was this rustling down below us, and we didn't know what it was. One of the guys, I guess, he got a little excited, and he opened fire. Well, everybody opened fire down in their area with the machine guns. Of course, we didn't hear, not once we started hearing baying, we found out nothing but sheep down in there. We didn't know it. We're killing sheep. Of course, we all stopped firing by that time, and of course, there's a bunch of dead sheep down in there.
Oh, dear.
We didn't know any better. But we weren't going to take a chance either.
That's right.
Yeah. So we got through that a little bit, and we kind of made a laugh joke out of it, you know. But other than that, it was quiet that night. But we had taken the Siegfried Line, and we had continued moving forward.
Uh-huh.
And then we got into, it was kind of quiet. I mean, we were having some fighting, but there was like a lull in between. Between the Siegfried and when we got into Belgium, Luxembourg, and Germany, we had gone in through that area there.
Mm-hmm.
We had captured one little town, I remember which one it was, and of course cigarettes were at a premium. And we had gone into this one little town in Belgium, and there was a store, I remember a grocery store, we had gone in there to check it out, and the racks were piled with Lucky Strike cigarettes. Remember the green pack? And we went, how are these guys getting the cigarettes? And we don't have them. We go, what's going on? I never forget that little store. And there were the husband and wife team, and we were a little upset. Wait, where are you getting this stuff? That'd be black market.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, needless to say, we took our cigarettes.
Well, now, at this time, had you had very much contact with civilians as you went?
Not too much.
Not too much.
No, we had very little contact with civilians, because usually they were gone by the time we got there. Yeah. They were evacuated. Yeah.
What about contact with the enemies? Had you been taking prisoners up to this
point? Oh, yeah. We get little towns where we'd find a few prisoners. I remember one time we found four guys. There was a pig pen, and these guys were hiding in it. And you could, I mean, we actually felt sorry for them. They were German, older German soldiers, and they were all huddled up.
Yeah.
And we looked at one another. And as soon as they saw us, comrade, they put their hands on their head and they surrendered, and they were just normal GI, German GI. And we found a lot of stragglers, a lot of German stragglers. We would pick them up, and we'd get them together, and we'd have to take them back to the company headquarters or wherever, and then they'd take them from there.
Yeah.
Other soldiers, like I was telling you before, you noted officers or SS troops, because the other soldiers would avoid them if they could. They didn't want any part of the...
And you said they
were real.
They took off their insignia?
The SS troops, usually when you saw a soldier that had a clean spot on his collar, he was either an officer or an SS troop. And you didn't usually try to take them prisoners. You tried to avoid them if you could.
Mm-hmm.
And when you had an officer, you knew right away, because the other soldiers would avoid him, because he took control. You can see that. You can pick it out right away.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones we want to question.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And we would tell the lieutenant, who was acting a little different from the regular soldier.
Yeah.
And they would send someone in, call him over and just come on with us.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't tell if he was an officer or not. They would take off their insignias.
Yeah.
And they would concentrate on questioning that certain person.
Mm-hmm.
Because they think they could get more information from him
than
they could from the regular soldier.
Sure, sure.
So that's another area that, mm-hmm. you know.
So where did you go next then, following?
Well, from the Siegfried, well, that was when we got into Germany. But I think before that, we got into, when we started going across, we were the 28 was the first division into Germany.
Yes.
According to the paperwork.
Yeah, according to all of
them. We started going into these town called, when we started getting into a lot of action. This was late October. When I was telling you, we were going on patrols. We went on patrol this one night, and there were about five or six of us, and we must have went 1 to 2, maybe 2 miles to our right,
mm-hmm.
our right flank.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't run across any American soldiers. And we thought, wow, there's something wrong here. You know, we should mm-hmm. at least run into somebody. And we didn't. And on the way back, I remember we made contact with a German patrol, which we opened fire on each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think I told you about the kid throwing a grenade. We're in the woods.
Yeah.
I said, you don't throw grenades in the woods. That thing get a bouncer come back and hit you, you know. But thank God it didn't hit a tree. And we opened fire on each other. And then when we got back, I remember we told the lieutenant, there's nobody on our right flank. We went almost 2 miles. We didn't run across. We didn't encounter anything here.
Uh-huh.
He says, I know. He says, we're kind of light. We're vulnerable
sure.
on the right side. He says, yeah. He says, we're waiting for troops. Now, this is getting into late October, November now.
And so the weather was changing?
And the weather's starting to get cold now. We're starting to get snow flurries. And
did change. You get any different boots or different equipment?
No, we still had our same boots. Matter of fact, I had leggings. And a couple of times I woke up during the night, my pants were frozen to my leggings. And we didn't have time to change clothes. I think at one time I went something like 47 days without changing clothes.
47 Nothing days?
Nothing. You just... You're going, you're moving.
Yeah.
Between patrols, and then they had me doing wireman work on top of
and
that.
And when did that start? Because they had asked you to...
Oh, this... What did I go by? I'd say it was around September.
So that's when they came
when
to
they
you
started
and said
using
they...
me as a wireman.
And tell what that entailed. What as a wireman?
Well, the first time when we were in combat, the lieutenant had asked me, he had called me in and asked me, he said, you know, Tom, he said, I have word that you were trained as a wireman. I said, yeah. And he had asked me, he said, how would you like to take a break and go back to battalion headquarters? He says, run the switchboard for a while. I said, sounds okay to me. He said, well, at least you'll get a hot meal there and you'll have a bed to sleep in. Well, bunk at the hell. I said, okay. So I went back and he was right. For about 3-4 days, I was operating the switchboard.
Uh-huh.
And it was pretty good duty. It gave me a chance to sleep
yeah.
in a bed,
yeah.
clean up, and
yeah.
have a hot meal. But that didn't last too long. So they started sending me out fixing wire and yeah. running wire and laying wire, which was actually worse than infantry fighting, because there you're pretty much going. You're going 24 hours a day. You don't get much sleep.
Now, how heavy is the equipment that you have to carry?
Usually we ran, I forget the numbers now, I think there was called 30 wire, which was a reel. It's on a reel about that
uh-huh.
big around.
Uh-huh.
And you ran that first. And once you established the communication, then they laid the heavier stuff.
And did you usually lay that on the ground or under the ground?
The light stuff we laid on the ground.
Okay.
Or on bushes or shrubs.
Sure.
Until we had a line of communication.
Connection.
Once it was established, then we laid the heavier stuff overhead.
And that's when you had to start climbing trees?
That's when we climbed trees. Now, the only time you climb trees are like around a road. If we could dig a trench across the road and lay it in there, it would be preferable. But if we knew tanks and trucks were going to come through, we put them overhead higher than the antennas on the tanks.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Of course, a couple of times while I was up there stringing wires, I hear this plinking and somebody shooting at me. And I kind of come down pretty fast. I was trained. Uh-huh. Thank God I had a fellow by the name of Howard when I was in basic training.
Uh-huh.
He was a telephone lineman. And I remember he told me, he says, whatever they teach you here, he says, forget about it. He says, I'll teach you how to be a good. And we became friends. And he showed me how to get up and down a pole pretty fast. I could come down pretty fast.
What's the secret?
You had the hooks.
Uh-huh.
And what you did is you just brought your knees in and your hooks broke out.
And
you come sliding down and you had the rope. We had a rope or a belt. And you come down maybe 10 feet and bring him in, stop, come down, bring him in. You can come down pretty fast.
I bet.
I mean, you can get down real fast without...
Especially
so he
when
taught
you
me that
hear and, pinging overhead.
And I used to be able to get down pretty fast on those trees. And I learned that. So that helped quite a bit. And that was the only time we strung overhead.
But you're not with your unit if you're stringing wire.
No, you're not with the unit.
You're kind of...
You're on your own. I had a guy by the name of Schroeder. I'll never forget. This guy, he was unbelievable. I don't know if he was all there, but I'll tell you what, I'm glad I had him. Because he was pretty sharp. We used to string wire. He usually went out as a team.
Uh-huh.
And we had to string some wire one time out to another company. And we were going through a field. And we got caught by the Germans. They were sipping up on the hill. And they were firing at us. I know, man. And there were dead cows all over this field. Now, we had to dive behind a dead cow. And this thing was all bloated. We got no place to go because we're out in the field. And these guys hit us. I mean, they got us cold. We're
yeah.
dead. And we're hiding behind this cow. And they're shooting at this cow. And all the ones they're hitting, and it's... Oh, the odor was unbelievable. God, it smelled. I mean, it was bad. So we stayed there until it got almost dark, and we came back.
Snuck out.
So on the way back, he says, wait a minute, Tom. He says, wait here. I said, why? He says, just wait here. I said, where are you going? He says, I'll be right back. So he goes out, and I hear bang. I hear him shoot. What's going on now? What he did is there was a cow out there alive, and he shot it. I said, what are you doing? He says, we're going to have steak tonight. And I said, He says, just wait here. So he went back and got the Jeep. And we had the Jeep with the with the big roll of wire behind it that was on the bank.
Yes.
And we took the wire and we wrapped it around the cow. And we dragged that thing all the way back to battalion headquarters. And I remember the whole side of the cow was all wore out and there's guts coming out of it. Oh, God. This was the good part of the fight, the war. So we dragged that thing back and he took it over to the sergeant in charge of the kitchen. He said, "We got a cow out here." He says, "Somebody shot it." He says, "As long as we're dead, we don't want it to go to waste." The guy looked at him, he says, yeah, he says, "I believe you." So he came out and they strung the cow up that night and they dressed it and they made steaks. And in the Army, you had these big aluminum kettles, the big ones. They cooked this thing and they filled them up with steaks. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. We stayed there. And they took them out to the guys out in front, our company. The guys had steaks that night. They woke them up and gave them steaks. We had steaks. I'll never forget that. I mean, that's the levity part of it. You know?
What a story that is.
So we had some fun there. But this guy, he was something else. Schroeder, I guess, I don't think he was all there. But another time we had to string some wire right around Aachen.
Yeah.
And we got to this company. I don't know what company it was, but we had run the wire. And once we were in there, this lieutenant, I don't know who he was, what outfit he was, he said, he stopped us. He says, "Where are you guys from?" We said, "We're from the 110th. He says, "Not anymore." I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "You're part of us." He says, "We're trapped. We're surrounded." So we had a one-star general. I don't know who he was. He had us out in his field. And he was telling us, he says, "Boys," he says, "we're surrounded by the Germans." He says, "So you're not part of my outfit." He says, "That's it." Okay. So we were trapped there 3 days. And I remember our K rations, they had these hardtack cookies.
Yeah.
And I hated them because they used to cut your gums. And I threw mine away. Well, 3 days later, I'm out there digging around for that stuff. And I found them where I threw them and I ate them.
Really?
We didn't have any food. Because we didn't have any, they didn't, did he give us any food?
So were you under fire or were you,
no,
it was
we
just,
were
quiet?
Trapped.
You
we
just knew.
Trapped.
You just knew.
So we were there a couple of days. Schroeder says, "Come on, we're going back." I says, "You're nuts. How are you going to get back?" I says, "We're going back. I ain't staying here." I says, "Schroeder, we can't. I'm going back." So that night, it was pretty black, pretty dark night. He says, "See where we strung the wire?" I says, "Yeah." He says, "Have they cut it yet?" I says, "No." He says, "They don't know what's there. There's no Germans there, right?" He's making sense. I says,
yeah.
Okay. So we followed our wire back, and sure enough, it was open, but we could hear Germans in the
all
distance.
All around.
They were in the distance. So we worked our way back. We got back to our outfit, and we saw Lieutenant Bundorf. "What are you guys doing back here?" "What do you mean?" "You're supposed to be in with the wire crew." Stoddard says, "Man, they don't need us anymore." He looked at us. He says,
he was a character.
He said, "What'd you guys do?" Schroeder says, "I'm not going to stay over there." He says, "I belong over here." The lieutenant just shook his head. He says, "I don't know. We'll do what you guys." And he walked away. So we went back. And that's when we started stringing wire. And then we stayed with the outfit then, our outfit. And I remember November 1st, because that was All Saints Day.
Yes.
They says, "Get ready, boys. We're going into a big push." And we did. From November 1st to November 9th, it was a lot of heavy fighting going on. Real heavy fighting. I don't remember what town it was. But I do know we went through the town of Hoffen, H-O-E-F-E-N. And I remember we hit a bank. They were shelling, and there was this German money all over the place.
Oh,
German
really?
Marks.
Yeah.
And we're taking it and stuffing it.
Yeah.
The lieutenant said, "What are you guys doing?" He said, "We're taking some of his money. It's no good. It's German money." He put it back. "It's looting." He let us put it back. We had to put all of it back. And I got one little German coin. I still have it. I should have brought it. I'll show it
to you. Yeah, we'll do it next time.
It's a 1937
Yeah.
What's his name? Hindenburg, I think, is on it, this picture.
Yeah.
He's got the German swastika.
Yeah.
And that's the only coin I kept as a souvenir. But that night, I remember another thing we found. We found a patch with potatoes in them.
Uh-huh.
And we're digging them up.
Yeah.
One of the guys, what are you doing? He said, potatoes in there. So we dug them up. We cut them up, cooked them, and ate them. That was a good meal for us.
Oh, yeah.
But that night, I remember, I says, we decided to sleep in this house, in this little town of Hofen. We had taken the town, it was clean. And I had a picture of it, but I can't find it. And we went upstairs, and there was an old mattress. I said, man, we're going to sleep in a bed tonight. Well, it was on a bed, it was on the floor.
Yeah.
So we slept in that mattress that night. What a nice, that was the best night's sleep, instead of being outside. And during the night, we heard a loud thud. You know what it was. We woke up the next morning, and I remember we went outside. There was a well, water well there. And right alongside of it, there was a bomb. That thing had to be that big around, embedded right next to the well, and it didn't go off. If that thing had gone off, we were gone. And we're looking at them, we're looking at each other, and we're just shaking our heads, you know. Thank you, Lord.
What a close call.
This is the way it was all through. You had many of these close calls.
All the time.
Many, many times. A lot of shelling, and you just never got hit. Another night we had, this was before I mentioned it, before we got there, a German tank. We heard a German tank coming in. It had a flamethrower. Mm. And he came right into our area. This was at night. And there's no way you can call in for artillery support because you're going to hit your own men. That thing came in and he created havoc with us. He just took that thing and he had a flamethrower and brought it. Covered the whole area from here to that street up. That was bad. That was a sickening night because a lot of our boys caught in their foxholes. And they were just burned to death. I mean, it was horrible. And I remember one guy, we went over to him and he's just saying, help, help me, he's black. There's nothing we could do. We couldn't touch him, but he's still alive. I'll never forget that as long as I live. I mean, it's horrible. And another time it was real bad for me was the lieutenant had put me in. They had called a truce. This was later. We were fighting up around, this was up around near Hofen there, the same area where all the fighting was taking place.
Uh-huh.
They had called a truce with the Germans. But we were like on a hill on this side and they were on a hill on the other side. I'd say maybe 400 or 500 yards between us. It was kind of open. A lot of dead soldiers in there, both sides.
Yeah.
And they had called a truce to go in and get your own people. And he had assigned you to that duty. And you had to go out and pick up body parts and put them in mattress covers. And we would tie the dog tags around the mattress covers and drag them out to the road. And all you saw was mattress covers lined up. The 2.5-ton truck would come by, pick them up and put them in the... I went up to the lieutenant and I told him, don't ever put me on that duty again. I said, I don't ever want that duty because you just picked up body parts. And that was another horrible day in my life. But...
That changes you forever, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you'll never live... You'll never be the same. You'll always remember that. And I just thank God for all my comrades that gave their life for me.
Yeah.
Passed away. It's just no words can't explain it. But that's another one. But getting back to the latter part of where I was, when I came out, Stringman Wire again, they called me and says, Tom, you're going to have to help this It was, I guess he was either a warrant officer or a second lieutenant. I forget what it was, but he was connected to some battery battalion, field artillery. He said, we have to run a communication between the observation post and the artillery. He says, he's going to call in coordinates because they're going to do some shelling. He said, we're going to go into an attack. Said, all right, and this was November 8th. Cold, real cold. We had snow that night. And we were soaking wet. We were still wet from the, you know, mud and rain and whatever you had, snow. So I laid the line that night. I was with him, and he had telephone communication. And I stayed with him that night. And we were there all night, and we said, we're not doing nothing until the morning anyhow, because that's when they were going to go into the attack. Another attack, that is. We were making attacks from the 1st all the way to the 9th. We were making a push. And that morning I had gotten up. We were in a, it was like a fire break in the woods. And in the fire break, there's a ditch. It's maybe 3-4 foot deep. And there's water maybe 6 to 8 inches, 10 inches deep. And there was a little thin layer of ice on it. It was frozen cold in there, very cold. So that morning when I, daybreak, I went to stand up and my feet were numb. I kind of fell down again.
Yeah.
Lieutenant said, what's the matter? I said, I don't know, my feet are numb. I didn't feel any pain, just numb. He said, take your shoes off, let's see what's going on. So I pulled my left shoe off, and my foot just swelled right up, and it was a deep purple. I said, whoa. He said, take the right one off. So we couldn't get the right one off, we had to cut it off. And then when I took it off, my foot was almost black, all my toes. Oh boy.
So you had frostbite.
And he just looked at me and he said, you're finished. I said, what do you mean I'm finished? He said, you're going home. I said, what are you talking about? He said, get back to your outfit. Okay. Well, I got no shoes on now, or my socks. And the only way I can get back, because it's daylight now, the Germans are going to see you.
Yeah.
I had to crawl in this ditch through the water. Oh, maybe half mile.
Could you even stand up?
Oh, no, you couldn't, because the Germans
would see you.
Would see you. I had to stay in the ditch. I had to crawl until I got to the woods again, where the woods were.
So this was water and ice and snow.
I had to crawl through that to stay below the ditch, see.
You want to take a break here?
Well, let me. Oh, you want to take a break?
We're running out of time.
Well, where do we leave off here? Oh, crawling up through the ditch.
Yeah, so here you are with hands and knees.
Well, I crawled up until I got to some to the forest again, where I could get some protection. And I crawled out, and I'm crawling through the forest. I ran across a couple of soldiers, American soldiers, and they looked at me and they said, "Where are you going?" So I said, "I'm looking for some help." He said, "Stay right here." So they had gotten a medic.
Yeah.
And they just put me on a stretcher, and then the medics took me back to a field hospital where they bandaged my feet up with cotton batten, and they just kind of put a little tape over. And then from there, they took me to another field hospital, a bigger field hospital, and they kept me there for a while, and they put me on an ambulance, GI ambulance, and took me to Paris, France, and they kept me there 3 days. I had an incident there with a French nurse. Well, of course, they took all our clothes away.
Yeah.
I had a beard, and we were pretty dirty because we hadn't.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting in a wheelchair, you know, with the gowns they put on.
Yeah.
And I had somebody pushing me around. I said, would you do me a favor? He said, what's that? I said, would you take me into the shower? I said, I want to shower. He says, okay. So he took me in, he wheeled me right into the shower. I was still in the wheelchair. I just took the gown off.
Yeah.
We turned the shower on, and I'm taking a bath, sitting in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
And this French nurse comes in there, and she's yelling and screaming at me that I'm not supposed to be in there. And I'm looking at her, what's going on? She, get out. She comes in and pulled me out and threw a towel at me. And she's pointing at my feet. I'm not supposed to be in there.
Oh.
I'm drying myself. At least I took my shower. I felt clean. Of course, I still had a beard and everything. Oh, she was mad because I was in there. Evidently, I wasn't supposed to be in there until they decided what they were going
to
do.
What to do with your feet,
what
yeah.
they were going to do with me. For. Oh, she was mad. She was really mad at me. And she threw another gown at me. I put that on.
Did she speak any English?
No, she didn't speak any English. She was just French. And that
mm-hmm,
was it.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept me there for a couple of days, and I don't know, until they evaluated what they were going to do.
Yeah.
I said, well, okay. You know, so then they put me on an airplane, and C-46, I think they were. They had them set up with the...
With the with litters. The,
with litters in them. Put me on there, flew me to England, and they stuck us in a barracks. So they were like a barracks. And I remember they had a coal stove on one side and another coal stove on the other side. That was it. And they kept me there from up until January, the end of January. And that's when they started checking me.
Yeah.
For my feet, and this doctor come over. And when I looked at mine and I looked at other people's feet, and I told you it before, some of them, they were still white and they were cutting their feet off. And I said, oh boy.
So you thought...
I thought, I'm gone, you know, they're going to be taking mine. And this one captain I had, for some reason, I don't know, I think the good Lord just sent him to me. He kept checking me with a pin. And he said,
to see how far you're feeling.
And he'd get up to about here, and I could feel it, but down here, I couldn't feel anything.
Yeah.
He said, well, he said, I don't see any signs of gangrene. He said, so let's just leave it alone and keep giving you treatment. And the only treatment they gave us was Whirlpool.
So you had
that? Morning and at night. And every day, they would increase the temperature a couple of degrees.
Just gradually?
Gradually. Very slow, maybe. I don't know what the temperature was, but we'll assume it was maybe, say, 80 degrees or 90 degrees, and they would bring it up maybe a couple of degrees every day.
Yeah.
Until they got to a point where I could feel it.
Yeah.
Well, he said, do you feel it? And I started to feel it in my feet. I says, yeah, I'm beginning to feel something. He says, we're good. So we left it going. And I just kept taking the treatments for, I don't know what, maybe November, December, January, almost two and a half months they were treating me there.
Meanwhile, you saw other
people. In the meantime, I'm hospital was a bed patient or wheelchair.
Yes.
And somebody pushed me around.
Yeah.
And I remember a guy pushed me around. His name was Snedden. I remember him. Comical as they come. Used to push me around, and he always had comments. I go, what's showing at the movie tonight? He go, Tom Mix and Cement, or Him and Her in Love Wanders Away. He'd always come up with a wise, but he was very comical, very mm-hmm. funny, and then I'm glad I had him as a valet to push me around.
Yeah.
He was very good, very, took me to lunch, took me to, you know, breakfast, and he'd always take me to different places. And,
yeah.
And he was... And Snedden, his name was Snedden. And I always remember him. So then he sent me a car back to the States. And by that time, I was walking. I had to wear exercise shoes.
Where did you come back to?
I came back to New York.
New York.
And they gave me about a week furlough.
Mm-hmm.
They says, you can go home. And then come back, and we're going to send you to Denver, Colorado, for a special hospital for treating trench feet and frozen feet.
Yeah.
It's okay. Well, needless to say, living in Buffalo, I was supposed to come back, and they had a snowstorm, and I was late. And on my discharge papers, you see one day, AWOL, because I got back too late. I was supposed to take the train back. And,
yeah.
And they... Forget it. You're not going back until a day later. So I came back to New York, and instead of sending me there, they said that that's already gone. They said, we're going to send you down to Camp Butner, North Carolina. And I was there from January until August taking treatments.
Really? That's a long time.
Yeah. They kept me there and convalescing, and then they finally let me go. I got discharged on August 14th, 1945, VJ Day, the day Japan surrendered.
What was going on? What was happening around you?
I was in Raleigh, North Carolina, because I was going to go down to Florida to see my brother.
Yes.
He was still in the service. And we spent a couple days in Raleigh celebrating VJ Day.
Yes.
And then I went down to Orlando. And, of course, from there, I spent the summer with him and then went home to Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And that was the tour of my duty.
What did they do as far as the treatment
for the
whirlpool?
Whirlpool baths. That's all they did.
And so what they really did is probably just...
Oh, they never cured. I have poor circulation right now in my legs.
Do you?
And in my feet. That's one of the reasons I really got out of Buffalo, because Buffalo's very cold. And I had a lot of trouble in the wintertime with my feet. Now, down here in the summer, they burned a little, but it's nothing like compared to up there.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I still have poor circulation in my feet, but I live with it, and I can tolerate it. And I just thank the Lord that.
Yeah, you didn't have to.
That I can still walk around, and I never had to have my ampulated. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
I'm pretty good there, so I can accept that.
When you look back on all those experiences.
Oh yeah, I mean it's. I mean, I look back and I think about all the other, all my other comrades that they're in so much worse shape. That's why I volunteer at the VA. And I see a lot of old timers coming in. They meet even younger than I am in a lot worse shape than I am.
Yes.
And I'm just giving back a little bit to...
But nobody understands what they've been through except someone like you who has experienced something.
That's where I find I have trouble finding compassion with, like I was telling you before, where I see people over here complaining about incidents that are happening here. Of course, they don't have anything to relate to.
Yeah, that's right.
And to them, it's probably just as devastating to them, the minor situations they're going through compared to, and I look back and I see all those people overseas during the war, of what they had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no electricity, no food, no water, no place to stay. That's pretty devastating. You know, to these people.
Some of those horrible experiences that you had that you still have. Horrible memories, doesn't it?
Oh, you'll never forget them.
Do you have bad dreams about them?
Once in a while, they'll pop up. I mean, once in a while, I'll have incidents that show up, I mean, in my dreams.
And as we were talking about before, sometimes, you know, if there's a movie or something that's too close.
I was watching the movie Private Ryan. That's the closest thing you're ever going to come through in real combat. And I never watched it through. I just shut it off. I don't want to see that.
No.
That brings back some pretty bad memories.
Yeah.
Of
certainly.
But I feel what I went through was nothing to what some of the boys went through at D-Day and some of these major. Like I even though I was involved in one or two major battles, still nothing like what they went through. I mean, I could imagine what they went through, and it's just a different type of torture because they didn't have a chance.
Yeah.
They didn't. Some of these people in Japan and Okinawa and all these other islands, that what they had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
I feel I was blessed. What I went through was nothing to what they went through.
And you weren't captured as a prisoner of war?
No, I was very fortunate there.
You know, and you know people who had to deal with that.
Would deal with that, sure. I mean, I just feel, again, like I was blessed compared to what some of them went through.
Well, one of the things that I think would be interesting with you and I comparing some of those maps, we can maybe highlight, you know, exactly the path that your outfit took.
That's what I want to do. I want to see if I can find some the names on these maps.
And I think
and I'll just put a little circle.
I think we can put it together and
With a magic marker with a view through.
Yeah.
And then we'll just draw a line as to where it went.
Where you were.
Now, is there any, I don't know if you have access to it for the information. Is there any way I could, because I only remember a few people in my outfit.
Right.
Corey, said Captain Lieutenant Bundorf, fellow by the name of Scarsella and Schroeder. Oh, Scarsella, that's another incident I forgot about. I had to lay some wire. Lieutenant Bundorf gives me, he says, take Scarsella with you. I says, you sure have to? Do I have to take him? A little short guy. And he spoke broken English. I says, just take him with you. I said, but you don't know the first thing about laying wire. He says, I know, but I don't have anybody. I said, all right. Well, I had this 18 wire on a reel.
Uh-huh.
And I'm running up this hill. And I got about, he's supposed to be feeding the wire.
Yes.
I got about halfway through, and it's jammed. Now I got to run down. And as I'm up there, the Germans are firing at me.
Sure.
It's an open. I run all the way down this hill. What happened? I don't know. He says, he's speaking in broken English. He says, the wire tangles up. I says, that's what you're here for. I said, not to let it tangle up. Okay. Now, I take it again. I'm taking off again. I get a little further. Same thing. Now I got to run back down again, get this thing straightened out. This guy's no help to me. Oh, God. So I'm showing him again. It's okay. And the third time I get up there, and I'm almost to the top, and I quit. And again, I'm so tired now. I'm puffing. I mean, I'm beat. I don't care. I'm sitting there, and they're firing at me, and I can feel it. I just didn't care. I said, I don't care. I'm so tired. I said, I didn't have any sleep. I'm just beat. I never thought I'd get to that stage where I didn't care. I just didn't care. I mean, you want to kill me? Go ahead. I don't care. So I got to that point, and I never realized anything like that in my life. So finally, I got the wire over the top. Once I got rested up, I said, man, I must have been crazy. What am I doing here?
Not a good decision.
So
not a good decision.
I let it go. And of course, these are experiences that you, after a while, you think back, I wasn't too smart what you did that time. You know? It wasn't too bright.
Oh, gosh.
But when we were in the Hurtgen Forest, of course, there was, when they shelled you, you hit the trees. See, it was pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And I remember I got two other guys, and I said, you know, we went up to the lieutenant. I said, Lieutenant, we're going to be going pushing ahead. He said, no, he said, we're going to hear for a while. He says, build yourself a good hole. So we went out, and the three of us, we dug a pretty good sized hole.
Yeah.
And we had an entrance and an exit.
Oh.
We made two. And what we did is we took some logs, of course, that the shells already had
broken trees.
And we just took them and we set them up. We made like a cover for it. For this hole. This hole would take the three of us very comfortable. And we had stacked it up and we put our shelter halves over the top and then we put limbs, tree limbs and stuff in like the fir trees.
Yeah.
We covered them up so that they look like a sure. camouflage. And we had a real nice down in there because now we could put, we had these little canisters with alcohol burners.
Right, right.
And we can keep warming with this thing.
Yes.
Hey, this is good. So that's at least right. give us a chance to change, dry our socks and stuff and put them on there. And so we were there for about 4 or 5 days and it was pretty nice.
Yeah.
And we were able to take stuff and heat some food on these little burners, these alcohol burners that they gave us.
Yeah.
And plus you could burn something without the light getting out at night.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
And we had a little ventilation coming through there. It made us pretty comfortable there, so we were comfortable about 4 or 5 days. And every time they'd shell us, we didn't care because now the fragment, unless it hit us direct.
Sure.
But it would hit and come down. You could hear it, but it wasn't hitting us because of the So we just kind of made a little pillbox for ourselves there.
So was that boring for the 5 days?
No.
There was enough action.
It was rest. It gave us a chance to get some sleep and some rest. That's what it was, because we weren't getting much sleep.
Yeah, so that's a little breather in the action.
This is before we went into the big push.
Yeah.
Before November.
Yeah.
That's when everything broke loose.
Yeah.
That's when all hell broke loose in November.
Yeah.
Late October, November. And right after that, I had left. And that's when the Germans made the push.
Yeah.
Again, I was blessed again. Yeah. Or if I had been there, one guy told me to hold off it. You saw the December 1st?
Yeah.
He said they just cleaned this right out. Not rolled off it. That's why I say I don't even know if they're alive. I was just trying to find...
I think there are some ways. I don't know how we would even contact... Well, we'll try to get the correct spelling when we get off the tape and see if we can't find... Any, because there are so many ways now on the internet.
Right.
You know, so many.
See, I don't have a computer.
And organizations that might link us up. So
if there's some way I could even.
Sure.
I don't know. Get you connected.
Well,
I say Lieutenant Bundorf, Corey.
Yeah.
And Schroeder and Scarsella.
All right. Okay.
And Scarsella, he was a little Italian guy from New York.
Uh huh.
And he used to love going looking for souvenirs. And we'd tell him, Scarce, stop it. You're going to get blown up one of these days because you're going to go into a house that's about booby trapped.
Yeah.
We couldn't get through to him. And I remember one time they had changed the code.
Yeah.
The password.
Yeah.
And he had gone out looking around.
Looking.
And it was dark and he's coming back. And whoever was on guard duty that night, of course, they said, who goes there? It's me, Scarsella. He says, he gave him the password. He gave me the password. He said, what? He gave the day before password. He said, that ain't our password. He's ready to shoot.
Yeah.
We heard his accent. We knew. And one of the guys said, don't shoot him. He said, Scarsella. He says, he better put his hands on his head when he walks through. He says,
yeah.
So he did. And we told him, Scars, put your hands on your head before you come in. He did. He put his hands on his head. What are you doing out there? You know you ain't supposed to be out there.
Yeah.
He said, I wanted to get some soup. No more.
Uh-huh.
He said, next time, no more.
Yeah.
He quit after that. That was the last time he went out. But he was all right. He's just that. But it was, like I said, they treated us good in the hospital. They took care of us. I mean, there's a lot more experiences, but they were just sidetracked to what you get, basically what you went through. And I'd like to go through here to find out,
see
if I can plot.
If we have some, either some visuals or some things that we can give Deborah so that she can go ahead and add that to the record. We'll put on.
Did you want to show her that other tape?
I will.
Oh, okay.
I will.
Okay. I don't know why it plays on mine.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I think we can figure it out. Okay. Well, anyway, for this record, just thank you very, very much.
That's pretty much what we saw. And like I say, this took place between July and November 9th, about 5 months.
Well, you've been very gracious to share
all that.
Thank you. We appreciate it a lot.
It was nice of you to have me.